awareness about war. So however long creation has been around, however long human beings have been on this earth, however long people have been living in one place or gatherings of people in one place, large enough to have armies, war seems to have existed. Someone has remarked, the most persistent sound which reverberates through men's history is the beating of war drums. I'm guessing that if you're more than 12 years old, you've heard the word war. You may not really understand what it means, but you've heard of it, and heard of it, and heard of it. And if you're more than 50 years old, and you think back to when you were about 12, you've heard of a lot of wars. Some of them were very small, very short-lived, and some of them seemed endless, like our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq. There are different kinds of wars. There are political wars. Those are the ones I think we have the most familiarity with, it seems. These are fought to gain land, or people, or power, money, prestige, or intimidation, prosperity, at least for some, resources, reputation, and national pride. These are the kinds of wars that are launched by a leader or a people who want these things. And then there's independence wars, like our country's battle for independence from England back in the late 1700s. And there's revolutionary wars that are fought to gain the change of the nature of a country's government. And as it turns out, our war in the late 1700s was both a revolutionary war and an independence war. We wanted both a change of government, but we also wanted independence from the government that dominated us. There's civil wars, like we had, that aren't trying to change the government per se, but they're trying to change some perspectives and some policies within that government. There's revenge wars, you know, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Sometimes these are family wars that grow larger into clan wars, and sometimes even into national wars, one nation against another. And there's class wars. We hear about that more than perhaps experience it. But we did experience it in a very visible kind of way here in this country in the mid-1960s, not so far away from us in Los Angeles, some place called Watts. Betty and I were undergraduates at the old LA campus of Pepperdine in the late 1960s, and with an African-American fellow student, we got to go into Watts in 1969. I'd been back from Vietnam for about a year, and Watts looked like Vietnam. But it was a class war. But there's another grouping of wars, and they're often woven into these other wars that I've just mentioned. These are what you would have to distinguish as spiritual wars. We are familiar today increasingly with the term cultural war. Like we as Christians are experiencing, as we see in our society, some very definite attempts to destroy Christian beliefs, either through influences of media or of philosophies, or of laws. And we feel very strongly about these cultural wars because we feel like we're on the losing end so often. And we know if we kind of broaden our scope that it's not just Christians, but it's people of all kinds of faith who are losing in this cultural war, so it seems. And then there are religiously manipulated wars. You know, from early on, historically, in all places, many political leaders have used religions and gods to justify the wars that they want, particularly when the leader of a nation had placed himself in the position of being a so-called representative of a god, or being that god actually on earth. Leaders then pitted the power of their god against the powers of another nation's god. And they stirred up the people by way of this. And then there's what I would term spiritual forces wars. The nation or nations of one religion is stirred to fight against the nation or nations of another religion. And we saw that historically in a very strong way with something called the Crusades. Today, we're seeing another war of that nature, at least so it is presenting itself. And it's currently Muslim extremists against everybody else. But they feel it very strongly as a spiritual force war. They see themselves as the forces of right pitted against all others who are the forces of evil. The Old Testament tells us what seems like countless wars of the Jews of ancient Israel. They fought to obtain freedom from their oppressors. They fought to gain land and wealth. They fought to maintain their lands, their livelihoods, and even their lives. But careful examination of the scripture reveals that all of these wars were in fact spiritual forces wars. We see this very clearly in Exodus chapters 7 through 14. The 10 plagues which Israel's God, Jehovah God, brought on Egypt was God's war against Egypt's false gods. In each plague, Jehovah showed his superiority over Egypt's gods. So we have Tannin, the snake symbol of Egypt, being pitted against God, as God shows his power with Aaron's snake eating these snakes of the wise men and of the magicians and of the counselors of Egypt. We find Hapi, the water god of the sacred Nile, being pitted against God, who takes all of this water in Egypt and turns it to blood, and all the fish in the Nile die. We see God, a Jehovah God, pitted against Het, the god of resurrection, and bringing these frogs out of the Nile and covering the land and in houses, and then them dying within just days. We find the very land of Egypt, the ground itself, yielding up gnats or mosquitoes from the dust, and the land itself became a curse to all life. We find God pitting himself against the land of Egypt itself as a sacred thing to the Egyptians, when he causes dense swarms of flies to go over all the land and ruin it. We find him pitted against Hathor and Apis and Ptah and Menevis and Heliopolis. And he gives death to all the horses, donkeys, camels, cattle, sheep, and goats. And these gods were the gods of all of those things. We find that God pitted against Imhotep as he brings about furnace soot in the fine dust, which brings boils on the Egyptians and their animals. We find God pitted against Nut and Isis and Seth as God brings down hail from heaven to beat down the fields and to strip all the trees and beat on people and animals in the fields. And we find God pitted against Isis and Seth again as God brings the locusts who eat the remainder of what's left in the fields and beat on people and all of the trees, making them barren, covering the ground, filling houses. We find God pitted against Re and Adam and Atum and Horus in bringing total darkness over all the land for 3 days. We find, finally, God pitted against Pharaoh himself and their god Osiris as he brings death on the firstborn of every Egyptian every slave, and all the cattle. All of these were direct assaults of Jehovah God on these false gods of Egypt, over their supposed power, over their supposed abilities. With the final plague, most of Egypt had been physically destroyed. When you think about what's happened with each of these plagues and the consequences of them, in your mind's eye, you can see a land that is literally littered with dead fish, dead frogs, dead animals of every kind that they had, a dead land, and dead people. It's a horrendous sight. When we think of Armageddon, when we think of some horrendous end through nuclear war and the aftermath of that, this is kind of what we would see here in Egypt after God, Jehovah God, is done fighting against the supposed gods of Egypt. They had not lost a physical war. They had not lost to an enemy with superior strategy or superior training or superior armaments or superior number of soldiers. Egypt had not lost to any of that because they were a powerhouse. This was a war of spiritual forces. And all of their gods had been overcome by Jehovah God's superiority. This was clearly a war of spiritual forces. Despite this, despite the losses that became very personal to Pharaoh, this leader of Israel, of Egypt, he refused to admit defeat. Talk about having a death wish. But not just a personal death wish, a death wish for your entire country, for everybody in your country, and right down to the land itself. He gathered his army, what was left of it, what was left of whatever animals he could draw into this, and he followed Israel into the desert. But in a conclusive act of his superiority, God drowned all of them in the Red Sea. And God's people Israel looked on to this with nothing less than amazement. Exodus chapter 15, and verses 1 through 12 tells us this. Then Moses and all the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has hurled into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deep waters have covered them. They sank to the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you threw down those who opposed you. You unleashed your burning anger. It consumed them like stubble. By the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The surging waters stood firm like a wall. The deep waters congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy boasted, I will pursue. I will overtake them. I will divide the spoils. I will gorge myself on them. I will draw my sword in my hand and will destroy them. But you blew them with your breath, and the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Who is like you? Majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders. You stretched out your right hand, and the earth swallowed them up. You know, in English literature, we sometimes read these odes to great warriors, to great kings, to great generals. It talks about all of their great glories and victories in war. And boy, doesn't this sound like it? This is the first one we come across in the Bible. It's an ode to the warrior God of Israel, who effortlessly destroys his enemies. And his enemies are false gods and the would-be god, Satan. The false gods evolve through people's minds from the lies told by Satan to people who want to have a different God than Jehovah God, a God who's made according to their desires, a God who they can control, a God who does and shapes a life and a world like they want it to be. So when God entered into a covenant relationship with Israel, he said in Exodus chapter 20 in verses 2 through 5, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." God wanted it clear in their minds that it was him alone, or it was these other so-called gods, these idols, these things that were figments of imagination and of personal desire. But it couldn't be both, because God, Jehovah God, was at war against these and against the one who derived them in people's minds. Added to this is the call by God to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. So any temptation to love someone or something in addition to or more than Jehovah God becomes a war of the mind, a war of the heart, and a war of the soul. This is a war of spiritual forces, a war between Jehovah God and the false gods of our desires, inspired by Satan. Each war that Israel encountered in the course of their journey to Canaan, each foe that they came up against, was not simply a physical war. It was instead a war of spiritual forces, because every enemy that arose as Israel was in this long period of years going across the desert represented a false god. Every one. Because Jehovah God was only the God of Israel. As far as any other nation was concerned, they had their own gods, multiple gods, maybe one chief god, but multiple gods, and only Israel had this one Jehovah God. God was showing his consistent superiority over the false gods of pagan peoples. So each battle Israel faced as they entered into Canaan would be a battle to show Israel that they must depend upon Jehovah God and not on the false gods of the peoples around them. We know that after Moses died, Joshua took his place and led Israel on into the promised land of Canaan. And we know that there were a series of battles that went on. There was a war, literally, for the land of Canaan. And as we read about it in the book of Joshua, we know that this was not a pretty war, if there is such a thing. This was not a war of people being overwhelmed by the sheer size of Israel's army and just laying down their weapons and giving in. No, they fought, and they fought mightily. But after Joshua's death, Judges chapter 2 and verses 10 through 15 shows that the wars Israel would engage in from there on were wars of spiritual forces. They were soul wars. So the writer of Judges in chapter 2 and verses 10 through 15 says this: after that whole generation, the generation of Joshua, had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then Israel did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. Now that's not the name of a country. That's not the name of a family. That's the name of false gods. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths, another group of gods. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. Now that bit of introduction to this book of Judges tells about what would happen over and over and over again. All of God's prophets that would follow this time, during the time of the kings, all of God's prophets warned Israel against their idolatry, warned them against serving these other gods and idols, warned them against embracing them and trying to keep their feet in both camps, God's camp and the false gods' camps. All of them, over and over and over and over. It warned them that this was the war of the mind and of the heart and of the soul. And they warned them what would happen to them if they did not return wholeheartedly to God. That God would use actually their enemies, these worshipers of foreign gods, of false gods, to overwhelm them, to beat them down, to take them. But Israel would not listen. Israel had literally wed themselves to these foreign gods. And God calls them adulterers because of that, even prostitutes. And so exactly what God said would happen did happen. God allowed them to go right into captivity, those who didn't die in the process. War will be fought on this earth in all forms, just as it has from early on, until Christ returns to bring everlasting peace. Next week, we'll see how the New Testament treats the soul wars that Christians are involved in every moment of our lives. In the war of spiritual forces, in these soul wars, these wars that battle for our souls, our eternal lives, every one of us, each one of us, is involved equally. Because each of our souls are at stake, so each of us will choose a side. Each of us will choose a god or series of gods. We have complete freedom to do that. God doesn't manipulate us. God doesn't control us to do that. He lets us choose our own. And with it, he lets us choose our own consequences. If we choose for the gods of this world, the gods of our own minds, the gods of philosophies, the gods of our desires, well, we'll get what goes with that. But we'll be facing up against Jehovah God, the God of creation, the God of the universe, the God who sustains all that we know. choose for God, Jehovah God, then all the blessings that God has in store that go generation to generation, that go day after day, will be ours to enjoy eternally. We choose our side. We choose our God or gods by obeying and disobeying. If we enter into a relationship with Jehovah God, if we get in that covenant relationship with Him, if we commit ourselves to Him and obeying Him in the ways that He's called us to, then we've chosen life in the fullest and longest sense. If we choose some other god or gods, we've chosen a moment, but we haven't chosen life. Each of us are always in the process of choosing a side, a god or gods. It really is a moment-to-moment thing. It would be nice to think that once we have said to others, I am choosing God, I'm humbling myself to Jehovah God, I believe in Him, I'm going to obey Him, I want to have my sins washed away through baptism, I want to become united with God, I want to become a son or daughter of God, I want to have the blessings of God here and now and forever. If that were just the end of it, wouldn't that be wonderful? But we know that we're tested moment by moment, aren't we? We know that we've got to make this choice over and over and over. Each day when we get up, we've got to face that challenge. In this situation, in this situation, in this situation, in this situation, what God am I going to choose? Will it be Jehovah God and His will over my will, or will my will and my false gods dominate? Have you made a choice of spiritual forces in the war over your eternal soul? Because, folks, there is a war, a spiritual forces war that goes on every moment. And that's not to be depressing, that's to be realistic. And deep within ourselves, we, everyone, know that, don't we? We know the challenges that we face every day. We know the decisions that we're fighting with every day. We know the faith that we're fighting with every day. The faith to hold on to God even when it seems crazy, and the ease with which we can put our faith in some other false god, at least for the moment. What choice of gods have you made? What choice will you make today? Will it be the god of your own desire and of your own fabrication, or will it be Jehovah God who fabricated you? If we can be of help in